BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Today, a trial in Rwanda, which reveals how the country is being run and the part played by its global intelligence network. The military, who staged a coup in Myanmar, are determined that the press and those who continue to protest should not call their coup a coup. And remember when eating out was a pleasure, something to talk to your friends about? Trouble in Paris under lockdown, though, as there's now a scandal about clandestine dinners for the elite. First to Jordan, often portrayed as a stable and moderate country under the wise guidance of its royal family amid turbulent times in the Middle East, the chaos in neighbouring Iraq and Syria. But recently there's been a family feud between King Abdullah and his half-brother Prince Hamza, formerly the Crown Prince. The royal rift, apparently the result of Hamza's aligning himself with critics of the palace, along with visiting numerous tribal leaders, causes Jeremy Bowen to reflect on his encounters with the country's power struggles.
Winter in the mountains of the Levant can be cruel. When they buried King Hussein of Jordan, a storm lashed Amman, his capital. The rain ran down my back as I stood in the freezing crowd along the route taken by the cortege. On that day, in February 1999, the road was lined with Jordanian soldiers with their red and white kefir scarves wrapped around their heads and faces. Wind tore at the mourners. The assembled dignitaries included four American presidents, three British prime ministers and the Prince of Wales, as well as scores of other world leaders. Yasser Arafat of the Palestinians was there. In 1970, he fought a war with Hussein for control of Jordan. Palestinians who lost called it Black September. Hafez al-Assad of Syria lined up to show his respects. When fellow generals accused him of betraying the Palestinians in the 1970 war, Assad seized Syria and threw his rivals into jail to rot until they died. His son Bashar presides over the ruins of his country 50 years on. Also at the funeral was a solemn-faced Benjamin Netanyahu, then in his first term as Israel's prime minister. 2 years earlier, he'd almost wrecked Israel's peace treaty with Jordan when he sent assassins to Amman to kill Khaled Mishal, one of the top men in Hamas. The Mossad hitmen bungled their attempt to squirt poison into his ear. Mishal survived. He was also at the funeral. I find myself thinking of Hussein's tumultuous years as king whenever I hear Jordan described as an island of stability in the Middle East. It is an image the Jordanians have worked hard to cultivate. This week, the strains have shown. Jordan is stable compared to its neighbours Syria and Iraq, but that's only relative. It's the result of a huge effort of will and powerful internal security agencies. Hussein became king when he was 17 years old. 2 years earlier, a Palestinian had shot dead his grandfather, the first King Abdullah, in the Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Hussein, standing next to him, escaped unhurt after a bullet bounced off a medal on his chest. The next day, Hussein carried a gun for the first time. He survived many other attempts to kill him. Perhaps the present King Abdullah's decision to put his half-brother, Prince Hamza, under house arrest for alleged sedition was inspired by his father's example. King Hussein had an iron will when it came to his two most important objectives, preserving the sovereignty of Jordan and the rule of his own Hashemite dynasty. Abdullah versus Hamza isn't the first palace conflict in the Jordanian royal family. Days before King Hussein died, he deposed his own brother Hassan as crown prince in favour of Abdullah. Hamza was Abdullah's crown prince until 4 years later, when the new king replaced him with his own son. This week, in a speech read out on Jordanian state television, Abdullah spoke of Hamza's betrayal. He said, "Nothing could compare to the shock, pain and anger I felt as a brother, father and guardian of the nation." The king did not produce evidence of the conspiracy he claims Hamza hatched with an unnamed foreign power. Abdullah has moved against other brothers before. In 2017, he sacked two of them and a cousin from their military commands. Time for some more family history. The Hashemite dynasty, Abdullah's ancestors, ruled Mecca, Islam's holiest city, for 724 years, until the ancestors of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, drove them out in 1924. The Hashemites are still custodians of Jerusalem's Islamic holy places. There's been speculation that MBS, who is warming up Saudi relations with Israel, might want to replace them there too. Is that connected to Hamza's house arrest? We might never know. We do know that Jordan has problems. They include corruption, poor governance, absorbing refugees from Syria and Iraq, and now COVID. 60% of Jordanians are under 30, and about a quarter of them are unemployed. Hamza was reportedly talking to discontented families among the tribes of Jordan's East Bank that have been the backbone of Hashemite support. Abdullah's troublesome prince is popular, charismatic, and he looks like King Hussein. This family saga has more chapters to come.
Jeremy Bowen. One of the striking stories to emerge from the slaughter of more than 800,000 mainly Tutsi men, women and children by Hutus in Rwanda in 1994 was that of Paul Rusesabagina, a hotel manager who sheltered hundreds of people from the killers. It was made into a notable film, Hotel Rwanda. After the genocide, Paul Kagame seized power and has led the country ever since. His critics claim the Rwandan state is behind a campaign of threats, harassment and even assassination attempts on them. Paul Rusesabagina has become one of those critics in exile, but late last year he was lured back to the country under mysterious circumstances, and now he's standing trial in Kigali on charges of terrorism, which he denies. Bikela Rong has spent years investigating what's going on.
At some point in their careers, most reporters will find themselves covering a trial. I've done a few myself, from urban guerrillas to war criminals. You learn a few things in the process. How hard it is in most courts to even hear what is being said. How impenetrable legal systems are to the ordinary citizen. How strangely detached the proceedings can seem from the shocking original crime. The other thing you learn is how unpredictable a court case can be, spraying out unexpected insights like a Catherine wheel, nuggets of information the state rarely saw itself sharing with the public. And so it has proved with the trial in Rwanda of Paul Rusesabagina, the former manager of Kigali's Mille Collines Hotel, a man once sympathetically portrayed in the film Hotel Rwanda, now accused of terrorism. Visually, there's something slightly surreal about these proceedings, thanks to the Rwandan habit of clothing detainees in baby pink shorts and shirts. It's strangely jarring to see Rusesabagina and his fellow detainees, middle-aged men accused of some of the most serious crimes on any statute book, in outfits better suited to five-year-olds. Rwanda is a supremely image-conscious African state, and the authorities must have thought proceedings would be a credit to its legal system. They arranged for the trial to be streamed on social media, with a helpful voiceover in English for those who don't speak Kenya Rwanda. But in the process, and probably inadvertently, they've given us all a fascinating glimpse into how President Paul Kagame's global intelligence system operates. His network really does span the world. I spent much of the last 5 years investigating how Rwandan intelligence doggedly tracks Rwandan opposition leaders, journalists, and human rights activists abroad, not just to nearby African states, but to Belgium, France, the UK, the US, Canada, and even Australia. Many have been intimidated into silence, attacked, or even killed. The Rwandan government steadfastly denies involvement, but the phenomenon has been described by Human Rights Watch and other human rights groups. Freedom House calls Rwanda one of the most prolific transnational repression actors worldwide, putting it in the same category as China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. One of the elements that came to intrigue me most was the use President Kagame's intelligence services made of informants, decoys, Judas-like figures. They were often people who were either already intimate with the men Kigali was targeting and could be persuaded to turn traitor, or innocuous bystanders persuaded to wheedle their way into their target's blind spots. As Rwandans like to say, the man who kills you is the man you trust. The technique is so often adopted that it implies endorsement from the very top. Paul Kagame may today be a respected statesman at African summits and on the international conference circuit, but his background was in military intelligence. Recruited in his youth by Yoweri Museveni's rebel movement, he trained in counter-espionage in Tanzania and operated for years behind enemy lines in Uganda's Luwero Triangle. When Museveni won power in 1986, Kagame got a job in Uganda's military intelligence and then joined a Rwandan guerrilla force secretly taking shape inside Museveni's own armed forces. After that group, the Rwandan Patriotic Front invaded Rwanda and took over in 1994, the men Kagame promoted usually came from an intelligence background. They created a state in their own image, in which a range of intelligence services competed to outdo one another. The most successful double agent was surely Apollo Kiririsi Gafaranga. He's a Rwandan businessman who maintained his friendship with the former Rwandan head of external intelligence, Patrick Karegaya, after the latter fled into exile in South Africa in 2007. There, Karegaya set up an opposition party. Rwanda's intelligence service cottoned on to their relationship and got to work. On New Year's Eve 2013, a visiting Apollo invited Patrick Karegaya up to his hotel room in Johannesburg. And two Rwandan commanders who had checked in down the hall burst into the room, strangling the former spy chief on his bed. Gafaranga is now wanted for murder in South Africa. The Hawks, South Africa's crack police unit, say there was evidence of direct Rwandan state involvement, which Rwanda's government hotly denied. But at a prayer breakfast in Kigali, only a few days after Karegaya's murder, Kagame had a different message for a Rwandan audience. Any person still alive who may be plotting against Rwanda, whoever they are, will pay the price, he said. Whoever it is a matter of time. And then in Cape Town this February, Saif Bamporiki, a shop owner and a prominent member of Karegaya's opposition party, was lured to the Guguletu township by a customer who insisted on having a bed which he'd bought personally delivered. As Bamporiki was waiting for his customer, two men with guns fitted with silencers walked up and shot him dead. The common modus operandi is one of leading people to unsafe or compromising environments where they can be attacked, says exiled Rwandan General Kayumba Nyamwasa, who I interviewed in a restaurant garden on the outskirts of Johannesburg while two bodyguards kept watch. And he should know. The general himself has survived repeated attempts on his life in South Africa, including one he believes was arranged by his personal driver. The driver was later acquitted of attempted murder and left the country. He's now believed to be back in Rwanda. Now, the Rusesabagina trial has introduced us to two more of these morally ambiguous characters. The first, Burundi-born pastor Constantin Niyonwungere, gave his evidence sporting gold-rimmed sunglasses, a dog collar, and a dangling silver crucifix. He's the man who made possible what Kagame has gleefully hailed as a technically flawless operation, but most Western legal experts agree was an illegal rendition. Rusesabagina, an outspoken critic of the Rwandan government, was living in San Antonio, Texas, when he unexpectedly flew to Dubai last August. Rusesabagina has told journalists the pastor, who he'd known for several years, had invited him to address some church congregations over the border from Rwanda in Burundi. The pastor claims, instead, that Rusesabagina was bent on meeting leaders of the National Liberation Front, or FLN, a Burundian rebel group accused of deadly attacks in southwest Rwanda. In a classic piece of entrapment, Niyonwungere persuaded Rusesabagina to board a private jet supposedly bound for Bujumbura. It flew instead to Kigali, where the befuddled former hotel manager was promptly handcuffed and detained. Why had Niyonwungere done what he did, the judges asked. The Holy Spirit pushed me, said the pastor. He'd been haunted, he said, by a conversation in which Rusesabagina admitted the FLN militia had been responsible for an attack in Rwanda in which innocent women and children died. I was praying, I was fasting. The Bible tells us not to shed blood. But the most surprising informant unveiled in Kigali has been not a Rwandan, but an American. Most of day seven was given over to testimony from Michelle Martin, a professor specializing in social work at California State University, who briefly worked as a volunteer at the Hotel Rwanda Rusesabagina Foundation. It's a not-for-profit dedicated to promoting truth and reconciliation in Rwanda. During 3 hours of evidence, Martin claimed she had been privy to email correspondence about guerrilla activities and accused Rusesabagina of genocide denial. This is a slur regularly applied by Kagame's government to its critics. Martin makes for an intriguing addition to the roll call of Rwandan infiltrators. Kitty Kurth, spokeswoman for the now-dissolved foundation, says that during Martin's time there, she'd encouraged Rusesabagina to join forces with the FDLR, the guerrilla movement created by Hutu extremists who committed the 1994 genocide. That would have put his organisation beyond the pale in the eyes of many Rwandan Tutsi. Perhaps the most eyebrow-raising detail, though, is how much Martin was paid by the Rwandan government for her help. A generous $5,000 a month, according to what she declared on the US Department of Justice website, where American citizens are required to register lobbying carried out on behalf of foreign governments. Rwanda is the world's 11th poorest country and heavily dependent on Western aid. The fact that its intelligence services were willing to shell out $5,000 a month to an informant says something about President Kagame's priorities. Rwanda this week marks the 27th anniversary of the 1994 genocide, always a grim moment in the national calendar. Rusesabagina's court case will continue, but he has withdrawn from proceedings, saying it is now clear he cannot receive a fair trial. Whatever the eventual outcome, by the time these hearings come to an end, the world will have learnt a great deal about the methods Kagame applies to keep his tiny country obedient and under control.
Michaela Wrong. Myanmar's armed forces now have total control of its government, but not of its people. There are still strikes and demonstrations to show resistance to military rule. Protesters are met with rubber bullets, tear gas, batons and live rounds. Journalists trying to report are also targeted. Access to the internet and satellite TV is being limited or blocked. Non-state-owned newspapers stopped from publishing. Independent news services closed down and some social media blocked. Ben Dunant has just returned to the UK after 6 years in Myanmar.
It was 2 months into a nationwide uprising against military rule, but on the taxi ride to Yangon's airport, I passed through what looked like a pacified city. The few pedestrians on the streets ambled past shuttered businesses, looking warily about them for police or soldiers. In the tense quiet, the city's banks were islands of activity. People queued in the hope they could get some cash, which banks were struggling to provide amid a strike by workers in the sector. Looking at this forlorn scene, the countrywide street protests of February seem like a dream. Those demonstrations have resembled a carnival, with impish homemade costumes and placards mocking Myanmar's vertically challenged military chief. With security forces then showing restraint, older protesters freely took their kids along. But over the past month, the protests have been reduced to deadly games of cat and mouse between small groups of young, hardened demonstrators equipped with homemade shields and Molotov cocktails, and security forces who met revolutionary slogans with rubber bullets, live rifle fire and grenades. By the time I left, the skirmishes were confined to a handful of working-class suburbs in Yangon, while the rest of the city had turned to more furtive acts of protest. These have included flash mobs and the daubing of streets with blood-red paint, to represent the junta's killing of more than 600 protesters since the coup. But I could see few signs of resistance that morning, my last in Myanmar after more than 6 years in the country. While crudely drawn graffiti condemned the military dogs terrorising the people with nighttime raids and mass arrests, the main actors in Myanmar's protest movement seem to have left the stage. To military chief Min Aung Hlaing, this might look like a return to normalcy, or peace and tranquility, to borrow the regime's official language. But scratch the surface of this new normal, and you can see the rot beneath. Besides the financial system on the brink, trade at Yangon's ports has come to a virtual standstill, and the city's rural migrants have largely fled back to their villages, prompting most factories to close up. This economic freefall is proceeding by popular design. A nationwide walkout in government workplaces and key industries is making it impossible for the junta to govern, and it may soon starve it of crucial revenue. This strike has come at a steep cost to the people, Many have had to give up salaries and even government-supplied housing for taking part. But several of them told me the threat of failure was existential. A future under military rule could simply not be endured, they said. With millions of small acts of resistance taking place every day, Min Aung Hlaing has authority over little more than his own troops. His coup is incomplete. The people of Myanmar know this, and they think they can win. In few places is this conviction stronger than among local journalists. Reporters and photographers have continued to head out to the remaining protests, and their publications have faithfully recorded the regime's brutality despite its bullying edicts, including instructions not to call the coup a coup. The military has arrested dozens of journalists and banned 5 media organizations, but the press has yet to be tamed. One reporter in Myanmar's second city of Mandalay was shot in the hand in late March, but after 2 rounds of surgery, with more to come, his biggest frustration was the enforced break from covering the protests. Typing with his one good hand, he wrote, "As soon as I can, I'll be back out there." Sentiments like these were reminders of what separates me from my Myanmar colleagues. I've obsessively thought and written about Myanmar for more than half a decade. During that time, I've taken only brief breaks from the country, and the extremes of its climate, with months of torrential rain bracketed by seasons of searing heat, came to feel more natural to me than the damp chilliness and tepid sunshine of England. But over parting drinks with my fellow journalists, I felt keenly aware that, for me, the nightmare of the military takeover was only temporary, something to be later analysed and fretted over from the comfort of another country. I was saying goodbye to people for whom escape to abroad might be possible, but can never be complete while infantry units storm the neighbourhoods they grew up in, while their childhood friends were behind bars, in hiding, or dead, or while the country, until recently so full of promise, slid back into being an object of pity and concern for the world. But the Myanmar people I know have little use for pity. The cost of resistance may be harrowingly steep, but they're unlikely to give up until they get their country back.
Ben Dunant. Rule-breaking has inevitably featured during the long periods of restrictions during the pandemic. We all miss certain freedoms, like the treat of a nice meal out. As you might expect, Parisians have been particularly pained by the closure of their restaurants and cafes. But for those in the know, well, there have been some secret arrangements now revealed to the wider French public. Many who hadn't been invited were outraged, and Joanna Robertson has been on the trail of the clandestine dinners.
At the heart of Montparnasse, the legendary brasseries of the Quartier 2020 stand deserted beneath awnings grown dusty and limp. Peer into their usually fascinating windows, and all you'll find is stack after stack of wicker cafe chairs, pulled in from the autumn sun of terraces almost 6 grueling months ago by penguin-suited waiters long since furloughed. But just along the boulevard, there's still a place to be found for dinner, if you know the right people. Lisette heard it from Aline back in February, who'd heard it while getting her legs waxed at Madame Ava's. Madame Ava knew because so many of her clients knew, and she was scandalised. The restaurant just across the street was running a private dining room down in the basement. There was even a bar. One had to have connections, of course, but things were running smoothly. The owner was great friends with the local chief of police, and they thought of everything. Because being out after curfew meant any clandestine diner had preferably to come accompanied by a dog. Walking the animal de compagnie, one's pet, is a rare exception under curfew rules. With a pooch in tow, one can go up to half a mile from one's home at any time of night. And so, along with the coat check cloakroom, it was rumoured, the private dining room had a dog check room with cushions, toys, chews and plenty of absorbent paper towels. With cafes, bars and restaurants closed since the end of October last year, some restaurateurs have given in to frustration and secretly reopened in defiance. Scandals broke back in January in Paris, with stories of dozens of the city's restaurants illegally serving lunch to friends, who then passed on the covert backdoor addresses to new friends. The newspaper Le Parisien swiftly dubbed the racket Les Gangsters de la Fourchette, the Fork Gangsters. Clients, the report claimed, included policemen, magistrates, and loyal customers, mingling together in a heady speakeasy atmosphere, furtively gobbling hot lunches in crowded back rooms. But Les Gangsters de la Fourchette proved to be a mere apéritif to the gastronomic grand plat of a scandal that broke over Easter weekend. Un dîner soirée autour d'un menu caviar et champagne. It had been there for all to see, posted on Chef to the Stars Christophe Leroy's Instagram site. An invitation to a lavish gastronomic dinner, but not an open invitation. This was an exclusive event for a wealthy, glamorous, hand-picked few, seemingly hosted at the sumptuous Paris mansion of a celebrity businessman and media personality. Unbeknown to organisers and diners alike, a hidden camera was secretly recording it all. The video footage ran the very next evening on primetime national television, revealing a clandestine world of glamorous evening dinner clubs and parties glinting with silver, crystal and candlelight. There was not a face mask in sight. Elegant round tables set with crisp linen and fine porcelain, all beneath the portrait in oils gaze of the Emperor Napoleon himself, dominating the cream, gold and crimson walls of the Empire-style dining room. Invited clients had paid €220, that's £190 each, for a gastronomic dinner replete with caviar, champagne and opulent dishes liberally garnished with truffles. The footage showed not just one dinner, but several, some at an unidentified luxury restaurant, where, yes, that very same chef to the stars prepared extravagant menus costing up to €490 a head. Only customers personally recommended by a certain unnamed exclusive contact would be admitted, diners were informed. An impeccably white-gloved waiter was recorded telling a diner, who happened to be an undercover journalist, "Once you pass through these doors, monsieur, COVID no longer exists." It was even said that government ministers had attended. As soon as the story broke, the Instagram posts vanished, leaving behind thousands of furious French clamouring for justice via a new social media hashtag, "On veut les noms," we want the names, which by Tuesday had intensified to "On veut les démissions," we want resignations. Charles de Gaulle once said, "Every Frenchman wants to enjoy one or more privileges. That's the way he shows his passion for equality." A poll taken the very same day as one of Chef Leroy's dinner parties found large numbers of the French public sceptical about the new lockdown, with almost half admitting they planned to flout the rules themselves. Bearing de Gaulle in mind, the scandal of clandestine haute cuisine might well just be a grand case of "c'est l'hôpital qui se moque de la charité," or, as we say in English, the pot calling the kettle black.
Joanna Robertson. And that's it for today. More from us next Saturday morning, as usual. Do join us.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey. I really hope you enjoyed that podcast. I'm here just to tell you about a new one on BBC Sounds called Life Changing, in which I get the chance to have some really, I hope, insightful conversations with people who've lived through some extraordinary challenges and experiences. Just have a listen.
I knew, I said, this is it. I didn't know where I was going, what I was going to do. And literally, like what is seen in the films, I just took apart my mobile phone and threw out the SIM card, and I just drove as fast and as far away as I could.
We just quietly stood there. Just the stunned disbelief. You cannot believe what you're looking at.
I just want to get inside your head here. You're sitting there in your house in Wales, yeah, and you're messaging a woman who's Malaysian royalty, as it turns out, also your half-sister. Yeah. I mean, have you got a cup of tea there with you, a packet of hobnobs? I mean, this is crazy, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Join us if you can. I promise you won't regret it. Subscribe now to Life Changing on BBC Sounds.